You are listening to Let's Go JoJo, the weekly JoJo's Bizarre Adventure podcast from Dynamite in the Brain and Secret of the Sailor Madness. So come along and hang with the Let's Go gang. It's Dwayne.
Hello, how are you?
It's not Niall because he's stuck on a train that broke down two stops out from leaving the station. And it's me, Brian, who hasn't taken his tablets yet, so hopefully I will not fall asleep.
So you're going to have to carry the energy because I'm on some, not sedatives, but painkillers for this cold I seem to have got.
I did have a long weekend though, so that may affect. Tonight's episode is, he switches windows so you can see what it's called. Green Day 32. And Oasis Part 3.
Mostly Oasis, but yeah.
Yes, because the Green Day taken care of.
I mean, like, there's still the recordings of the phone call there.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, and I guess they get reunited at the end.
Yeah, I was wondering what way they were playing it, because obviously in this episode he gets the second phone call and it's like, oh shit. But he kind of rejects the guy, and I feel like that's more denial, because when they're reunited, inverted commas, he seems happy to see him.
I don't know. I get the because it's like a sub and dom relationship, and now the person he thought was dominant is shown to be weak.
That's true as well. It changes the context of the relationship. Yeah.
And then
but in the moment, rejecting it.
And he sees a chance for him to become
the main
guy. Yes. Which is to get to that mysterious man in a wheelchair with binoculars in the Colosseum watching them and force him to tell him how to take care of the boss.
So the episode proper starts again, like, at the thing that we saw at, was that at the, no, that wasn't at the end of episode one. That was at, like, during the start of episode two. But just to kind of do the catch up to, and then Bruno ran across town and he chased him underground.
Yes.
Mm.
And the bulk of the fight is, he gets tipped off eventually that, Chocolat has died when he realizes the,
when he gets the second phone message, yeah.
It's when the mold has disappeared.
Oh, yeah, because he can hear the emergency services coming in and everything, and he's like, wait a minute, but everyone should be dying. Shouldn't be allowed on the roads. Yeah. I'm guessing the reason it's not hitting him is because he's spending most of his time underground.
Yeah, so basically it's Bucciarati's trying to stop Secco from getting to the Colosseum now, rather than anything else.
And as he comments, is like, I think this guy might have been the actual fucking threat here, because, you know, he's fast, he's strong, his power is crazy good, and he knows how to fucking use it. He's smart. You're kind of screwed with this guy. He's the whole package.
Yeah. I guess some clever bits of fighting with Bruno, of like the unzipping the pole that he throws at him.
Oh, yeah. Zipping it. Like, having it so that he threw essentially two halves of a pole that would zip back together and chop his head off, but he deflects it, nearly cutting Bruno's head off. Just like there's some nice back and forth. Yeah.
And he starts to go underground himself using sticky fingers.
Man, that, like, not only was that cool as shit when I saw it happening, like, cause I was kind of thinking, like, well, he could fucking zip his way into the ground, into that little pocket dimension shit. But it was really, like, a trippy thing to fucking watch with your eyeballs.
Yes.
Especially when they did the shot that was like, you know, the camera that's partially underwater kind of thing, but partially under the street as they're swimming and zipping their way through the underground.
I think it's also a bit early on when Secco's like mad for not knowing how Bruno is still alive or still moving when everything points to the fact that Bruno's is dead.
Yeah.
He's chasing the vibrations, but Bruno figures that out, so he breaks.
The sound carries like it does in water for him. So, yeah.
Yeah, so he breaks a water pipe and causes it to hit against itself.
Mm.
And then Sekko like turns the tables because he knows, well, if I can't detect it, that must mean that Bruno's stood still. So I will liquefy. What does he do first? Does he start liquefying Bruno first?
I think
first,
it's towards the end.
He spits the.
He takes mouthfuls of street into his mouth and starts spitting them into the air, explaining that as soon as they leave his touch, they stop being liquid. So he's just spat like long shards of street into the sky, which are now going to fall on the street, which he's still in and is technically liquid. So it falls through his spikes, messing up Bruno. I think it's after that Bruno starts melting because he's like, I was playing the long game. If my power melts the street, imagine what it's going to do to you for when you're underground for a bunch of time.
That's when he has to deflect them, and then that tells Sekko knows where he is then, and then starts liquefying Bruno.
Everything
becomes liquid. But it turns out that was Bruno's plan, because it causes things in the street to sink into the ground.
And he just needed some stuff to use against them, like the tires on this car you just caused to sink under the street.
Yes, because Sekko's thinking, I'm too fast for you, you're not going to be able to hit me, but... turns out the punch wasn't going towards Sekko at all. It was going towards this tire.
Using the thing of sound carrying further in underwater, for lack of a better term, to burst his eardrums, which was like, there was a bunch of this where it was like, ooh! And then like when he's deafened and he goes above ground and his leg gets run over, I was like, oh! There was a lot of like, I was like, oh, that sounds really painful. Just the thought of it, you know?
Yeah. He doesn't, he's like so arrogant that he doesn't think his eardrums have been burst.
He assumes it's like, wait a minute, but I can hear Bruno moving this way, but he obviously was swimming towards traffic in the street kind of thing. He's completely misinterpreting shit.
Yeah, and Bruno's like willing to like let him live, he just needs to get him to shut up.
And I assume he's just going to like unzip him and not kill him like he's done before. He's just going to unzip him and make him... functionless while he checks out the Colosseum.
Unzip his limbs and put a zip across his mouth. But he grabs a pink-haired boy hostage.
Oh no! A pure, innocent pink-haired boy disguised cleverly with a hat. I guess Bruno hasn't seen him before, so it's not like the worst disguise.
That's true, yes. Bruno just ignores Sekko's threats and punches through the child's chest.
And you're initially thinking, it's like, wait, has he fucking copped on that this is the guy? It's like, nah, he zipped straight through the kid's chest.
And Doppio is like, I knew he was gonna hurt me. I didn't even have to use my powers. I didn't have to make my eyes start go twitching.
I think he said he did do a prediction.
Yes.
Like to go like, okay, Bruno's actually gonna do this without attacking me, because he doesn't know it's me, so I'll be good.
And we see him pick his stuff up. He's got the end of the like the dangling phone not attached to anything.
I think there's like other stuff in that bag, like a banana and shit, where I'm just like, all of these things are potential phones, basically. And initially I was like, well, isn't he going to seem weird that he's totally like this total calm guy after some crazy man emerged from the street and threatened to melt him? And then, what happened? Bruno zipped through Doppio's chest.
Yes.
He unzipped, his throat, I think, or something nasty.
He attaches, apparently according to the wiki, which I'm using to remind me, he attaches his arm to his chest.
Oh, because he's going all muddy. He's going muddy from his own touch.
And then he falls and trips and falls in a truck, in the garbage truck.
And the same one.
Yes.
Still doing the early morning rounds.
And then Bruno's recovered from the effects of Sekko's stand, but then he's now falling apart at the seams. His body is just giving up.
The effects of his stand are no longer affecting him, but his body did fall apart and he has no ability to heal anymore by the look of it.
No, and Doppio is approaching as we hit the end credits.
It seems like not a lot happened, and I guess like because it was mostly that one fight, it technically didn't, but that was a really good fight, really good like twist, really good. I know what I'm doing. And also just the weird visuals.
Animation, this might be my favorite episode of the series.
I've really enjoyed some of the setups for the fights. Yeah, yeah. Seko's very good. And man, the amount of time Bruno in this episode alone like shouts sticky fingers, it's wonderful. I love it.
Yeah, because just once he realizes Chocolat is dead, he just becomes wild, both in performance and like the animation performance. It's like the loosest the show's been.
Yeah, the point where he initially made the dash for the Colosseum, where he put everything together. Hey, there was a guy in the Colosseum, and I think he was in a wheelchair. I wonder if he's disabled and all this kind of thing. Where he's like butt jiggled as he was running away, and I was like, guys, you didn't need to put that in, but I appreciate the level of fucking detail you're gonna do.
Oh, and we get confirmation of who this mysterious man was.
Yes, he reveals he had us fooled all along.
Turns out it was Jean-Pierre Polnareff.
Yep. He says that he took the arrow. I presume that's the same arrow that turned Dio, or at least Dio was using to make guys.
Yeah, I don't think Dio had to be turned by an arrow because he'd got Jonathan's body.
Oh, yeah, you're right. He inherited it, as it were. Yeah. Backwards, I guess, technically, but yeah, still.
Yeah, and I don't know whether the masks are made out of the same material as the arrows.
It could be all different kinds of meteors for all we know. Because the vampire thing seemed like a separate thing, but I'm guessing they try and tie it all together.
I don't think there's going to be. It's not.
There's no more masks anyway, for sure. But, yeah. He's kind of going over just like quick rundown of what happened, the Stardust thing, and what he's doing, and saying is like, okay, if they don't make it to me, I got to destroy this arrow because it's too fucking dangerous.
Yes.
That kind of thing.
It's weird that I presumably they just got split up at the end of Stardust Crusaders by the sounds of things, and somehow he's not aware that like the Speedwagon Foundation aren't aware that he survived.
Clearly he went off like when they had that tearful goodbye at the airport kind of thing. He just went off and went around the world, presumably being a badass adventurer, but in the process losing an eye and his legs. I mean, like, he was pretty fucked up at the end of that, but he did have most of his legs.
I can't remember how much
he lost. Like a chunk of, I feel like some of his fingers might be fake. I feel like he lost the chunk of his arm. I'm not sure if he lost a big chunk out of his thigh rather than his below his knees.
Yeah, I know in the comic he's definitely got a cybernetic finger because people were complaining that he hadn't got a cybernetic finger.
In this, isn't he wearing a glove? The same like a Joseph Joestar thing. I think it's. Only the cybernetic fingers are gloved, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm not sure it was this episode they're complaining about. I think it was the earlier shot we had of him.
Oh, okay.
They may have corrected it in this. I wasn't paying
attention. I'd have to double check. I feel like he's missing fingers on his left hand.
More busy.
I'll have to double check.
Looking up what Prince outfit that he appeared to be wearing.
Man, that fucking see-through butterfly eye patch thing was rad as shit.
Yes. I think it's like kind of based off a 1990 Prince costume. It's not quite the same, but there's like one thing where Prince is like wearing a headband as an eye patch.
I don't know what you call that, the kind of transparent material. I can't think of the fucking name of it.
Yeah, it's
right
not
now,
like a Gauls, like, that Polnareff's got, but he was definitely, I'm pretty sure I've seen Prince wear something similar, and so I looked at it. And it would make sense.
It's like a combination of Polnareff's old look and probably Prince and a couple of other things.
Yeah, given the whole gold experience thing, it would make sense. Yeah, highly enjoyed this episode. I think it was better than last week's. I did like last week's to a degree. It was kind of weird last week's felt a bit like. There's a Clark Ashton Smith story called The Return of the Sorcerer about a sorcerer who's like disembodied body parts start reassembling themselves.
Yeah. I feel like I've seen that in other things, but the idea that he's done it to himself both surgically and not and reattaching himself. Yeah.
Which is weird because the story which last week's Kitaro was based on also has a similar thing, but wasn't actually in the anime because they changed it.
It would have made a good like bookend to body horror to body horror for the show, but it didn't quite go that way.
Luckily, this week's Kitaro more than made up for the lack of body horror.
I got a lot of fucking questions about that, but I really enjoyed this episode of JoJo's. I feel like, yeah, like you said, this might be maybe my favorite fight of the show. I'd really have to sit down and look at them because I really love the physicality and the set pieces of the fights this season. They've been really good.
I think the other standout one is the guy with the ice.
Vanilla Ice.
No. No, the guy who's got the speed skating.
A great visual stuff. I really liked your man who could freeze stuff when he threw the shrapnel and was climbing across the chasm. Just kind of like really fun ideas. This season, obviously, he's been building up a collection of like, I've got a really fucking cool idea for a set piece for a power.
Righty ho, moving on to the show within the show, it's Let's Go. All the other stuff we watched this week, and to make up for Niall not being here, I somehow found time to watch more stuff. But we start with the regular, Dororo, episode 20, The Story of the Nue.
I mean, that's the story about the Nue, but yeah. I think it's more a personal story.
Yes.
Weirdly.
So there is a samurai who keeps on feeding folk to the Nue that killed his mum.
There's a super fucking sketchy looking dude who says, oh yeah, I totally go around killing monsters too. Come on, buddy, let's go. And it was just like, the guy isn't on the level. You can just tell the kind of creepiness of it, which is nice, like the way it was shot like that.
Yeah. And yeah, the first fight goes badly, which ends up with Dororo getting his hand stuck in a pile of rocks.
Yeah, they get knocked over a cliff. They're fine from the landslide, but Dororo's got his hand caught and water's pouring in. And they're all, and he's kind of like, I'll be fine. It's fine. We'll work it out. But it's kind of like, it's not fine because Yakumaru is trying to, you know, pull Dororo out. He can't. That just pulls his arms off. He tries to push the boulders off and he's ended up like breaking one of his own arms. And it's kind of the idea that he can do these amazing fucking things, but without his body, he can't do some very basic things.
Yes. And also he's like, also because he's softened up to Dororo at this point, which Dororo notices at the start of the episode.
Yeah. At the start of the episode, it shows their relationship and the fact that he says as much like you've changed completely from when we first met. You're like a different person. You're like a more whole person, but he's still not physically a whole person and spiritually as well because of what he's doing to have to become a physically whole person.
Yeah. And it's quite good that it gives you two different things that make you think, oh, that's the thing he's going to get back at the end of the episode. And then he doesn't get anything back.
Yeah.
So you think he's going to get his sight back early on when Dororo is describing the colours of the seasons to him?
Yeah.
And then you think, he's going to get his arm back because that's what he needed to help.
And that's the thing that literally broke on him. And that's happened before, like where he lost a false leg to get a real leg back, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And luckily the Biwa priest shows up, pulls out his hidden sword. And uses it to prize apart the rocks so Dororo can...
He breaks it to do it as well, which I'm guessing is to show like the sacrifice of violence for good, I suppose.
Yes.
To do the right thing.
I guess that's why Hyakumaru then goes berserk, because he's like, I need to get something back.
And yeah, because obviously at the start of the episode, he's in a good place. He sees that he's a more whole person, but he couldn't pull a kid out from some rocks, the kid who matters the most to him in the world kind of thing.
Yes.
And that's just eating him up, like, obviously, yeah.
Yeah, but I think he can still only express it as, I need to get back what's mine. Now, the question we have by the end of the episode is...
Yeah.
Is everything that he's got his, or has somebody already got bits of him and is using it for other purposes? Because we go back to like the phrase that the mum said is like, oh, the reason he survived because there was one demon that didn't manage to eat.
Like his head should have been eaten, I think is the way she put it. Yeah.
But he also turned at the end when he has killed the Nue, after the samurai has then fed himself to it. to mutate it, because I think that was the way why the samurai could never bring himself to kill it, is because we get like a little glimpse of his mum being absorbed in the same way we fully see happen to him when he gets fed into it. So basically, after you're eaten by this creature, then you like become another part of its chimera form.
So, yeah, because I guess it worked for this one being a chimera. Like Yakubaru chops off half its brain, you get a cross section of the head and the brain and everything, which is really nasty. But he grows out of that after being eaten. Like what's your man's name in Total Recall? Kind of like that, but out of the face.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is again like super kind of gross and everything, but it's interesting because obviously he's a mirror of Hyakumaru, a guy who had stuff, and then he cut off his own mother's hand to keep her from him back and getting away from the Nue. In a panic, basically.
Yeah. Talking of our extra heads, I believe we've got Niall with us now.
Oh,
what?
I've always been here. I've just been strangely silent.
Now, Skype has completely buzzed up on me. As it did to, who did this do it to the other day? It's just like a big blue screen to me now.
Oh.
Hopefully don't stick anything else in the chat because I won't be able to read it.
Okay.
I hopefully got all my notes. Yeah, we were just talking about, the end of the Dororo and, the story of the Nue. We see the POV shot of the samurai's head as Hyakubaru is finishing him off, and we see that Hyakubaru has got a bright red heart now.
Yeah, like a core of bad or evil or whichever way you want to put it. A core of rage, maybe.
Yeah. It's a void in him as well that must be filled, must be satiated.
Yes.
A demon part, I suppose you might call it.
Well, yes. I'm going to guess that whatever is slowly being rebuilt has swapped hearts with him or something.
We do get a thing of his brother as well, like trying to help out in a village that's seen some famine, you know, and he's being decent to the guy and his kid. He's making sure they get fed because he's like, yeah, I'm actually here to protect my people and everything. But
yeah,
when we see him later, obviously he's checking out the Hall of Hell because even the Lord has gotten the thing. I was like, hey, this Hall of Hell is kind of fucked. There's like some weird noises there. It's spooky. I'm not going in. But obviously the kid goes in and he sees that there's some sort of effect by one of the statues that's still standing, which is probably what's blocking Yakubaru getting anything back this episode.
Yeah, because I think we're led to believe that's the same thing that the ninja's reporting back to Daigo.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's not looking inside because it's spooky fucking Hall of Hell.
Yeah. Tamara really should not be making any sweeping definitive statements to the... to the local villagers saying, I will definitely make sure you are fed and cared for and everything will be okay.
Well, he's trying to make the hope. He's trying to bring the hope, and I think he thinks he can achieve his thing, and his servants are also like, oh, so he does have a bit of humanity left and everything. It's all presented for them as positive, but you can kind of see it's like, oh, that's not going to work out for y'all, bud.
Well, yeah, because we know that he's like forcing himself to be emotionless when he goes after Hyakumaru.
And it's clear that since he wants to help his people and he does care about them, he isn't emotionless. He does have that kind of core. I'm not sure if that's going to be his failing in the way that Yakimera's frustration and everything is his failing, but yeah.
Because we end with Hyakumaru declaring that he's going to go back to Daigo and get what's his.
Yeah, I think he says he's going to, like, does he say, is this one where he says he's going to get it off of his brother? I think he pins it on him or something like that. Or maybe he pins it on Daigo.
No, he's just going to go and get it.
Yeah.
It's kind of sad that he had sort of... He kind of accepted his lot a little bit because he had Dororo to hang around with who would tell him the things that he couldn't see or experience. But it was just until that boulder came down, he thought, well, with this body of mine, I was helpless to help this person I really care about now. And this fills me with, like... an impotent rage that I have to go out and try and satisfy and release.
Yeah, like we're saying, like at the start of the episode, he seems like satisfied. He says he's just happy to listen to Dororo's stories, and it's like, oh, I could just have you describe shit to me. That's pretty cool. But when he can't protect the thing that matters the most to him in the world, Dororo, it obviously puts him off the deep end.
Yeah. As like, you know, he's not completely whole. Like, he has these prosthetic hands that, you know, they happen in his day to day. They kind of have to feel things and grasp things, but they're only like instruments and tools, and they can break. And underneath, he's just got two blades that all they can do is stab and kill things.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He doesn't want that anymore.
Then we've got One Punch Man, episode 8, The Strong Ones Fight Back. Again, a title which covers a smidgen of the episode, because most of it is people not fighting back and getting their asses kicked by the people who volunteer to turn themselves into monsters when Goketsu shows up at the stadium.
Well, I think the strong ones of the episode would be Snack and Lightning Max.
Well, it's supposed to be like the S-class hero montage we get.
Yeah, but I feel like them, like, the kind of reveal where they kind of come back to save him, and it's like, why did you guys come back? And it's like, because we're heroes, like, what did you think we're going to do?
It's our job.
Yeah.
We may not be, like, the super duper strong like you, or possibly even this guy, but we still have a duty to protect the innocent.
Yeah, they're doing the same kind of thing, like, we get in this episode with Moon Rider, where it's like, yeah, these guys are still pretty rad, even though they're getting their asses kicked.
It feels like when Suryu confronts Goketsu, it feels a bit like that. They're deliberately mirroring Moomin Rider fighting the Sea King.
Definitely.
Yeah,
like a force you can't possibly beat. But Moomin Rider reacted to that very differently, heroically, whereas. not as much here.
No, because he's. Yeah, well, once he realizes he can't beat
that
him.
Once he realizes he can't beat him, when Moomin Rider realizes I can't beat this guy, he's like, that's fine, I just have to hold you off as long as I fucking can. Which is super badass.
Yeah, with Suryu, it's more sort of a despair, right? All of his strength that he gained for himself just to faff around was in the face of this, it can't do anything.
Yeah.
And he has to admit that maybe I can't be this unstoppable force that can just... like, be loafing around, and no one will dare question the way he lives his life, because he's tough enough that he can just, like, punch out any people who criticize him, but then they got something like this that is stronger than him, and then suddenly, like, his whole world of view turned upside down, much like himself multiple times as he's slammed repeatedly into the into the floor of the stadium.
Like, his despair is presented differently, because obviously he comes in with the confidence of, yeah, I can probably beat these monsters, fuck it, like, heroes do it and they're lame as shit, that kind of thing, where it's presented very differently to the people who give up very quickly and eat those monster organs, just chow down on those things, because obviously these people have seen what the hell these things are and know their own limitations.
Well, yeah,
and they're just like, yeah, okay, I give up, whereas he goes like, yeah, I'm not going to eat that. It's possible he would have had he realized his own limitations.
Yeah. And they've been made to feel weak by Suryu and Chiranko in the first place.
But I mean, like, basically they would have, like, if you were going to blame Chiranko, inverted commas, for that, it's like, yeah, it's clear that these are the guys who would have lost anyway. So it would have been like their despair was like a personal failing.
Well, yeah, because the first one who eats it goes to beat the guy, because he's brought everybody back from the hospital.
Yeah.
It goes straight after the guy who'd beat him, who's already injured.
Our perfect human arrives from the fucking sky. Apparently he was just thrown straight up. Kind of lands back down and is like, yes, I will become even more perfect after eating this.
But it is another one where you're like, how is Saitama not showing up? How is he not noticing this is happening?
Well, he was running away from the cops last episode. So I'm guessing he was just like running away in order to cleverly disguise himself as exactly the same guy, but with a different costume.
Well, yeah.
That was his plan, yeah.
We get some ideas of some of the other S-class heroes as well.
Yeah.
Is it Drive Knight? He appears to be Steel G, essentially, but in a smaller form.
Because he's cool.
He has a centaur form, we see. And we have Child Emperor fighting a Medusa monster with an Iron Man Shiba.
Yeah, I was going to say Iron Dog, yes. But yeah.
And we see just how good Watchdog Man is.
Oh, he's the real deal. that was pretty funny because, like, you know, you have your very serious character Garrow, who everyone loves, kind of going like, "Oh my god, he's not any fast and powerful, but he knows his shit." And it's just like, it's the guy dressed as a dog. He just sits on a pole all day.
Is this the first time they revealed that Garrow was the winner of the previous year's martial arts tournament?
I feel like they've suggested it. Like,
well, you put it together. Haircut. A guy in a wolf mask who knows karate. Who
wears a black
jumper. Who could that be? Who do we know who could correspond with?
I could be wrong, but I feel like they haven't straight up said it, but they have done like a cut between that wolfman mask thing to Garrow, that kind of thing.
His name is Garrow, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, I know. It's pretty fucking obvious.
Well, they do intimate that there was actually a wolfman who he was impersonating.
Like it was another dude's gimmick, the wolf mask thing. That was just coincidental.
Well, obviously, him now fighting a dog man, which I can't quite now see. Having seen him animated, even as roughly as this is, I was like, okay, so is he a man who dresses up as a dog, or is he a dog who's somehow grown a man's face?
Jin Men Ken.
I think he is a monster, but his monstrous form is cute doggy man, and that means that he's actually lovely, because monsters, as they say in this episode, have a predispondency for violence, whereas he is a predispondence for violence and loyalty.
But he wasn't trying to fight Garrow initially. He was just like, Garrow swinging the punches at him, but he's just like doing shake hand with the dog.
Yeah, he's just trying to grab the hand.
He's catching all the he's throwing the punches out like so fast, but he's getting the handshake in. Come on, shake. He's so quick.
And
good dog.
We also learned that Pig God is immune to poisons, and his power just appears to be eating things that probably should not be eaten.
Yeah, like a big version of Matter Eater Lad. That's a cool power.
But you could kind of see the physical consequences of what that
eating
kind of
shit constantly.
Body.
Yeah.
Is anyone else we saw at the S-Class Heroes? What's his face?
Zombie Man? Did he turn?
Zombie Man didn't turn. Tank Top Master
came in to save Moomin Rider,
yes,
yeah.
Saying that you shouldn't try and fight him that hard if you're not wearing a tank top.
My powers are tank top related.
Flashy Flash, that's the other guy who we saw.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was the last episode, I think we saw him.
Oh, was it the last episode? I watched them both together, so I can't remember.
Yeah.
Which ones were which episode.
I think there's a few more we come across in this one. But yeah, we do get the kind of montage of all them going, being about badass. And the Hero Association kind of saying is like, okay, we need to get all our top guys in on this, you know, and then the montage of that. But also we get the Monster Society's thing where they basically lay out the plan. They're trying to scare the general populace, make the heroes look like fucking assholes by doing this all-out attack, and also recruit some monsters on the side. So that works out.
Yeah. So, they're just luring. They're going to lure all the top heroes into their base now they've kidnapped that kid.
Mm.
And turned up. It ends with the one tough martial artist who Saitama accidentally knocked out, deciding that he's going to eat all the monster cells, which turns him into another Gonagai type monster.
Yeah, no, I was definitely getting that feel from it.
He kind of gets put. It comes across much more in the comic. The pair of them do, and yeah, he kind of like wants to fight Goketsu.
Because they're both like threat level demon, but it's like the other guy's a martial artist. Dragon, sorry.
And he points out, no, there's no point. Look, there's people even tougher than us, so just know your place.
Yeah, listen, I'm stronger than you, but there's fuckers in the organization higher up than me, so, you know.
So Goketsu wanders off, but he stays and is like, beats the shit out of Tsuriu, the injured Tsuriu, who's already been taken down by Goketsu. And,
yeah, and Tsuriu is kind of like begging for his life and everything. It's like, yeah, but I like picking on people weaker than me, and now I'm a monster, so doubly good.
And he's forced to call out for a hero. Mm. And then Saitama rolls up.
With his, you did good up to this point, yeah. I'll take it from here.
Again, yeah, again, like the Sea King.
Yes.
And again, good job. Nice fight.
Yes.
Like, from his point of view, it was like, oh, okay, he called out at the end, which is fine, because knowing your limits is good, but he figured he, like, fought his hardest and for great justice up to this point, where in this case, he's fucking wrong.
Yeah. I think the fight is incredibly short, so the point I was expecting it after the credits, but I guess we'll just have it at the start of the next episode.
Like, immediately defeated, because that's how these go.
Yeah.
I'm fine with that. But yeah.
Oh no, they gotta keep it in suspense until the next week. Maybe this time Saitama will fail.
No.
Then we've got Karakuri Circus, episode 32, Valediction. So in this episode, all our good guys are now essentially the Midnight Circus to Eleonore's Francine. They basically spend the entire episode trying to protect her happiness, because we learn.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
I didn't watch last week's episode, so forgive me if things we learned I say are new to me. We're actually in last week's.
So, oh, okay.
Apparently they watched all her memories on a movie screen.
Yeah, that's right. Narumi refused to, because he was like, I'm not watching that shit. She's an asshole, and I refuse to.
I had forgotten that he was amnesiac and did not remember his relationship with Masaru and Shirigane.
I didn't forget that, because I remembered when he saw her again, he was kind of like really cold and everything. It's kind of like the, not the assassination, but the change of his character. I haven't really liked the way they're doing it.
But they establish it to get rid of it this episode, so.
Yeah.
Now, had they established that LeFou's maids were all his own automata?
No, that is the first time that's come up in this episode. I think
in the comic he demonstrates it by like getting them to all kill them, a whole bunch of them to kill themselves.
Cool,
as
I guess.
To, like, assure him that they're not.
They're not a threat. They're still under control. Yeah.
The new, you kind of get the feeling, because you get like a bit of time spent with the guy who's obsessed with combat from the new four. And the Piero one from the new four is like, having them like counteract with seeing Pantalone and, Alessio, is that how they call it? It's like the other name for Harlequin. He's like, oh yeah, well, even these new four he's made are also going to be prone to having like personality problems just as the first four then.
Yeah. I mean, like, obviously in this episode, he, In flashback, he points out the flaws of all these puppets, that they're all entertainers at heart.
Yes.
Or as a base, yeah.
Yeah, because that's how he's like explaining how the circus performers are going to be able to fight them, is that the
if you don't come at them with a weapon and you're doing a performance, they will be compelled to watch and learn the performance. So, because they're all compelled to be weird, wacky fucking clowns.
Yes.
To make Doll Francine laugh. That is their base programming. They really want to make Doll Francine laugh. Even though Doll Francine isn't fucking there, they're just like, oh, I gotta learn new tricks. I gotta learn new wacky fucking personality quirks when I see them in front of me.
In more, this is information we could probably have used earlier, we discover that the head of the circus's wife had died in a trapeze accident.
That came up in last episode where they all give their tragic backstories.
Okay, right. Yeah. Yes, because I'd missed that a bunch of characters had died last episode. But they do mention it this, so it's fine. It works as a TV series. You can miss an episode and they fill you in with those details.
I know, but when you bring up your tragic backstory of your wife and mother in the acrobats case, and like they each have their own sad childhood story where they decided that this woman who adopted them was their real mother, that kind of thing. It's like that literally only came up last episode. Like,
anyway.
It might have had more thing, but the spider woman that's chasing the train looks exactly like her and apparently has her memory or something?
I think so. How they figured all this out. But I guess probably Faceless knows a lot of stuff. And we know he's a mega jerk.
It seems like a massive coincidence, but the spider woman goes like, my dear husband and children kind of thing. And it's just like, okay, that's weird.
Master wants to see Eleonore. They're like, no, don't. If you go in while they're having that conversation, is that really going to help?
Is that really going to help? B, we're literally going to shoot Narumi into space from which he's not going to return. So give him what time they have left together. And Master is kind of heading in, and the two puppets are guarding the door, going like, yeah, we'll let you through if you think it's for her benefit. So you can go on ahead. And he's kind of like, I'm doing it because I want to see them.
Yeah. And so, yeah, Eleonore and Narumi's amnesia fades because he remembers the casserole she made them in episode 3.
Yeah, they're eating like tin food, and he's like, this isn't as nice as your casserole. It's like the first compliment he's given her since he turned into a dick. And she's like, wait, so your fucking amnesia's gone? He's like, yeah, so what? Doesn't make a difference. I'm still going to be shot into space and shit. And it's just like, just the kind of cold shittiness, especially when you remind me of the wacky, fucking laughy, punchy man he used to be.
Yeah. And then the two surviving members of the original four come in because they've detected that they're about to be ambushed further down the train track. And they ask
permission. And they're going to hop off the train we need permission to go fight.
Yeah, she needs to tell us to go fight and win. And she says, yes, go fight, win, and stay alive. And they're
so delighted.
Enjoy.
It's like, holy shit, we got an order. Fucking A. They're so delighted to have a thing. And even they kind of do the thing of like, you know, they both go like, I'll see you later. Did I mention I could sing, by the way? I'm going to fucking sing when I get back. And your man's like, cool, I'll play my mandolin. See you later.
Yes, with those circus performers. It'll be great. We'll all have a happy ending.
Yeah, that's what the fucking knife thrower said after she got a knife thrown in her head last episode. So fucking,
those guys pretty much signed their own death warrants.
They might as well have fucking
how
like,
happy
talked about
they were
their...
heading out.
Yeah, they might as well have talked about how they're like, one of them is like about to get married and the other one's like fucking 3 weeks to retirement or something. Yeah.
Meanwhile, the surviving circus performers have got grim determination on their face and Masaru is flying off to fight the captain guy who thinks he's a human.
Yeah, he's flying into the air to fight that captain guy who has rocket boots. I don't think that's come up before.
Well, hey, that's more believable than being able to have some sort
fly
of...
fly around on a pumpkin, man.
...teddy bear factory underneath your skirt.
Yeah, okay, that's true. That makes a bit more sense. The circus have to fight the spider woman who looks like their... the ringleader's wife and the kid's mother. But I'm saying it because like it'll probably come up next episode. They all have one knife each that they got from the knife for a lady, which is poisoned with. I say poisoned. It still has Eleonora's blood on it, so it's poisonous to puppets.
Yes, there is a load of weapons that LeFou gave them, but they're not trained in using them, so they're going
to
stick.
It's like, well, I don't know how to use all these guns he gave us. We'll just use these three knives we just literally got. I assume they do know a little knife throwing.
Also,
you know,
the spider puppet is destroying the train at a rapid rate.
Yeah, she's just kind of eating through it with her flailing spider legs, basically.
I liked the way that everything like circled round thematically. Like the good guys are now in the position the bad guys were at the start, but doing it for the right reasons.
Like protecting someone else's happiness because it's the right thing to do, not because it's insane and will kill many people.
And it does a really good job of like capturing like some of the really great panels from the comic, like the bit where
they have some good stuff
where they bow to Eleonore to ask permission, and then when they leap out the door, which is, I mean, quite often with the show is like they always put like their best shot after the credits as if to remind you.
Yeah, yeah. Or like the shot that reminds you of like the emotional core to some extent. Yeah.
So believe it or not, I think it will probably stick its landing. It just had a very bumpy takeoff.
I feel like it's done too much damage to itself at this stage. Like, even if it's like, yeah, that was a somewhat satisfying ending, but I'm then reminded of all the other fucking shit that was rushed through. Like, the fact that these circus guys I don't know as characters really bugs me.
Yeah, I mean, it needed another 13 episodes. It needed
probably
first arc with Narumi and Guy when they're in Paris from the comic, which would establish so much stuff, which they had to like put in here and there, and it needed all the circus stuff that they just skipped.
Yeah, it's Karakuri Circus, and there's like no fucking circus.
It's definitely the kind of series you feel like you should only really watch if you've read the comic in its entirety and just like to see certain sections of it animated.
You say that, but there's plenty of people who are enjoying it more than we are, and they've never read the comic. Yeah. So,
well, I do think I would enjoy it more had I read the comic, because it feels like it's trying to do the greatest hits things, but it's running through a lot of plot where, like, as a person who hasn't read the comic, I can see you're leaving shit out, and it's really frustrating because it's like, I don't fucking know these circus characters. I don't, I'm not invested in them. They've been in like two episodes before this fucking final climactic battle.
But the other thing it has going for it, though, is it has a lot of good vocal performances.
Yeah, no, the performances are great. The animation is consistently quite good, or at the very least, the shots and the way the things look. Yeah, they're obviously basing that off the comic. It looks good.
Yeah, it's even what I was just sort of disjointed narrative they've put forwards in the Horse of TV series, it's still a completely mad premise. And that's a huge point within. I just wish there was some method to the madness in this incarnation.
Yeah, for example, why aren't they taking the magic fucking Karakuri train to Siberia? That's a thing that bugged me. I assume it was taken out in the comic at some point that no longer exists, because they're taking like a regular ass train, isn't it?
Yeah, I can't remember.
It got clamped. couldn't bring it around no more.
It has a crazy clown face and extendable arms. I'm not sure how you can clamp that. It's like, why aren't they taking that train? That train can run across the ocean.
Well, maybe it's the wrong gauge.
Yeah. What happened to me before I got home to get on this call? I mean, no, I've been here all the time.
Okay, here we've got Wacky TV Na Na Na, episode 8 of the second season, Lonely the Cave Gourmet, in which they eat cave soup.
And just do a big riff on the solitary gourmet.
It's a nice bit, because like, you're expecting like a weird, like, whoa reaction, but it's like, yes.
Nope, you know, it's a food manga.
The slow enjoyment of this weird-ass fucking-looking stew that the chief has put together for them.
Yeah. And so you're like, what's this little linguine put in there here? Oh, it's a bat I caught. And that's this thing that sets them off. I was like, what? Which is like really eloquently describing the layers and depth of flavor in this weird stew we cobbled together. But the bat is where he draws the line.
Well, you shouldn't eat bats, dude. They're
adorable.
They are, no, not because they're adorable. We eat lots of adorable things. Also, isn't it like they're just disease, like disease ridden, I think is the main problem.
Yes.
Like ticks and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. That'll boil off in the stew.
That'll mix that around in the stew. Oh dear.
It's like the puffer fish. You gotta like, prepare the back just right so you don't get any of the like blood viruses.
Then we've got Sarazanmai episode 8 first. I want to connect, but we'll never meet again.
Trying to run us through the ringer emotionally here, yeah.
So, again, I didn't watch the previous episode, so the only thing I needed explaining is Dark Kepi. Is that explained in the previous episode?
You get as much explanation as you kind of get here, whereas some aspects of Kepi that's been captured. I think it's something like he's been separated from his princely body or form. And
well, I assume it's something like it's happening with the kids. He's, what's that organ called again that stuck out of the butt?
The Shirakodama.
Yeah, the Shirakodama, like, or some equivalency, has trapped him in Kappa form.
Yeah.
So he's no longer capable of being a prince, and presumably that has made Dark Kepi or something like that. I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, presumably that's the thing which hit whichever one of the cops had to be rebuilt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's an aspect, too, of separating your love from your desire, and this is like Kepi is like Dark Kepi is some kind of unfettered desire, perhaps, and when that gets
because desire much, seems to be the impure thing, and love is the pure thing, obviously. Yeah.
Lash out and hurt people seems to be happening here, and yeah, it's again like you get as much clarity as in this episode as we've gotten before. Like, so it's just mentioned, dropped there after the credits last time.
Which makes me wonder if the wish the cops have got is to make Kepi whole again in order to make, I can't remember the names, which one.
Mabu is the one with the glasses.
Make Mabu
whole again.
It could have been, it's just straightforward. Our wish could be to make Mabu whole again anyway, but maybe.
But that's related.
Yeah, just like just a little thing again on the ticker tape, little news ticker we see on
Sarah's news
reports. Like, I have something important to tell the Kappa Prince, Deesh. Those two are behind it, and we don't believe it, but I don't think that those two are bad people deep down.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they're being played as much as everyone else. Like, yeah.
The two brothers, our criminal brothers, are planning on leaving town. What's the heat is on. And we get like a lot of the episode is Enter talking to is it Chikai, the older brother?
Chikai.
Yes.
Kuji. Yeah. Kuji.
Just as a quick run on the last episode, it seems like our main guy was back to normal, and our boys were finally coming together, and they were going to join the soccer team, and everything.
It was all going too well.
Yeah, you were just waiting for the fucking other shoe to drop, and the other shoe of dropping was what's the glasses kid again? Enta was trying to interfere with them getting closer, and he stole the dishes, so they couldn't be passed on to your man, so he could wish for his brother, presumably expunge his criminal record or something like that.
It just like landed on them that day because they're having fun. They have their little spot out there by the waterfront. It got trashed, but they worked together and they cleaned it up, and it was so much fun. But then Toy comes by saying, "Shit, my brother's back in. He's in a lot of trouble, and I gotta leave town with him. But I don't know what to do." Like, and I said, "Well, problem solved. We just gotta get one more dish for Kepi. I mean, get a wish off." And Enta's cool with this, apparently, because, well, that's what Kazuki... my wish is for Kazuki to be happy, so if...
And what he wants is for you to be happy, so that makes me happy.
I made me happy again. And it's like, we're all cool, we're all fine and dandy, it's all great. But then they do the whole job, beat the Kappa zombie, we get the little leakage of memories and things. And we find out it was fucking Enta, the little bastard, who trashed their... Or soccer spots, like repeatedly, to try and force this camaraderie among them. He's also the guy who stole the dishes, so they couldn't make the wish then.
And since they've been delayed and everything, obviously he gets the call from his brother last episode where it's like, yeah, we're gonna have to fucking move town. Things have gone to shit. So that's kind of put the kibosh in the relationship, and that's where they start in this episode where he's trying to say his goodbyes. Like, his brother gives him, like, a day, isn't it, to say goodbye to his friends? Because he knows it's like, I know I'm taking away from your friends and everything, but, you know, I can give you a day to get your gear in order.
Affairs in order.
And he's pursued by both the cops and also one of the Yakuza.
I presume it was the one making all the... The Bruce Lee sounds. Yes. Yeah.
Now, as an older man, he's now drawn as if he's from a Dooku Man manga. He keeps on doing the sideways, like, open the mouth and the zigzag tongue comes out.
Weird kind of beak-looking face with the snaggly teeth.
I like the fact, like, when he pulls a sword in someone, like, including the cops, he's kind of like, "You think that'll stop me?" And I was like, "Yeah, dude, I'm pretty sure gun beats sword." I don't care what mangas you've read, like, that's generally how it goes.
Yeah. And it is a real gun. It's not a magic gun that turns you into a zombie. To turn you into a zombie there.
The gun just kills you. Because it fucking kills you, and then you can be a zombie.
They're going halfway there. They do something else to take care of the rest.
Yeah, some of the cops turn up because they hear a gunshot, but then they flip little otter badges onto them, which apparently lets the mind control them.
Otter mind trick.
Yeah, well, it does kill him. There's no blood.
There's like a smoking fucking hole going through his head.
It was just so hot, it cauterized the wound as soon as it went under the skin.
Then we learn that what do they call it? The thing that Kazuki puts around his ankle.
I don't know.
I can't think of the fucking name for it. Yeah.
Football best friends bracelet.
Yes. That he'd originally got that from Toei when they were younger, because Toei was doing a similar thing to what we saw Kazuki doing at the start of the series of, like, abandoning everything which brings him joy in life.
Yeah, like his brother dropped the gun into the river and he dropped his soccer ball into it because it's like, well, I guess I'm not going to be a soccer star now. I guess I'm going to be on the fucking run for the rest of my life for his brother's sake.
Yeah, his brother gave up a lot for him, so he feels like he has to do something. Even though he didn't actually need to, his brother wants to take care of him, but he feels he doesn't want to be a burden on him. He wants to be an equal partner in this life of crime they're going to embark on together.
And like his brother keeps pointing out in this episode, it's like, oh, my brother used to be like really nice and cute. He's like a real softie. He's real emotional core. And it's like, that's not the guy we've seen, but he is talking about how his younger brother has grown up. And that kind of way, because he's not been allowed to have a childhood, is kind of the tragedy of it, yeah.
Yeah. But we kind of see, like, he's not that cute little boy anymore, but he is a much more of, like, a genuine character and friend than Enta has been. Enta is just constantly going, what the fuck are you getting so mad at me about that? I just, like, you know, betrayed them and lied to them. What's he getting so mad about me for? Because Enta is he's trying to force this connection to happen. Like, he's just not that into you. And he can't seem to get through that. Whereas, Toi is, and they kind of been organically becoming, better friends over thing. And he's jealous of that because he thinks, what's he got I don't got? Well, he's not obsessed with this whole, like, wanting to be best friends forever, only you and only, but only Kazuki and no one else could be friends.
He's not pushing it. He's letting it develop naturally. Like, he states, in this episode, that it's like, oh, I guess he still doesn't remember that I fucking put him on the path of soccer. But, you know, that's fine. It might bug him a little bit, but he's not going to let it bug him. He doesn't remember that childhood connection he made with this other kid.
Mm-hmm.
By talking to Terry's brother, he, like, learns a few things, and, like, basically the brother encourages him to make up with the pair of them. Meanwhile, we also see that Sara has created this fast freezing device, which Kepi ends up falling into.
Like a very convoluted thing. It was like, yes, we have this thing which can freeze them and then capture them. Totally thing. Also, I've made you dinner, and I'm going to be a klutzy ditz right now because she spills too much pepper. I think that's what sets her off.
But it's important because Kepi isn't there at the end of the episode.
Yeah.
When Enta and Kazuki are back at the Kappa Shrine. And they get cornered by the cops.
Because, like, the cops were, like, looming around, being threatening the whole time, but when they kind of showed up at this point, I was like, oh, okay. Because initially they were chasing Iran's older brother because they figured he'd make a good Kappa zombie because he's a criminal and shit.
Yes.
But they find another criminal, so they're just like, yeah, cool. Also, we found that kid who was hanging around with him. Hey, kid, where's the guy? Also, oh, sweet, the dishes. Those are ours now.
He just, like, led him straight to him. They already had, like, a pretty good idea where everything was lying. And that was kind of the fake out last episode. When we got to the shrine, we thought, the dishes are gone. Oh, the cops must have got there ahead of them. But no, it was Enta, but he still got played for a fool by them because he just led him straight to it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he takes a bullet for Kazuki. But the cops don't use him to... They basically tell him, now they got the dishes, they're not bothered. about making Kappa zombies, apparently.
Yeah, because they can make the wish, like, rather than just going by the otter stuff.
They say, well, if you call an ambulance, you'll probably be able to save him. But instead of calling an ambulance, he calls Toei. Again, text messages don't seem to exist in this. Well, they do exist when they need to exist as part of the plot, and they don't exist where they need to not exist as part of the plot.
I think it's just people have notifications for text turned off for the most part. Yeah.
Only Haruka answers their texts in this world.
But Haruka's from a younger generation. He's all up on the latest new technology.
Phones. Yeah. You've caused problems.
They're definitely talking about phones and missed connections and making human connections, like, by phone. That's definitely part of their fucking commentary on this.
And only realizing what connections you have and that you've lost them.
Yeah, that's particularly the theme in this episode.
Mm. Yeah. But also, as well, Toei had a line there at the start in the flashback when they were kids, that sometimes you... the dream you want to achieve, you got to, you know, do it by breaking off a connection or doing it by yourself. So I think in Toy's case, maybe the happiness that he wants, maybe with Kazuki and Enta, is like his friends rather than constantly giving up himself or his brother, because like, I think.
Yeah, living for himself, basically.
Like his brother, like maybe like sometime before, maybe he can again, like, didn't quite care for him, but he is as well kind of exploiting Toei and exploiting that kind of part of him, because he gives too much of himself. Mm-hmm. And his brother is kind of exploiting him in that way and just kind of like, kind of wrecking the life that this poor kid could have.
I don't think his brother is like doing it intentionally and he can see it's happening. It's just like, there's nothing I can do about it because I can't order him to not follow orders. I can't like tell him to not follow what I'm saying.
Similarly with Enta, like he wants his connection and he keeps like striving after it, but maybe he has to give that up that way or stop pursuing it so strongly to get the genuine connection with this person that he loves so much.
Letting it develop naturally rather than forcing it. Yeah.
So you got to maybe break it off and try and reconnect in a more organic way. And that's why he's so jealous, because he can't seem to do that with Kazuki, but Toei seems to do it so easily. What's he got that I haven't got?
Yeah.
And as well, like, you know, poor Enta getting shot and Kazuki just decked him and, like, chewed him out and...
Yeah, didn't forgive him for, like, fucking over his friendship with another guy.
Yeah, and, you know, to kind of leave it... No, well, we don't know what's going to happen. It doesn't look good, but to leave things on bad terms like that just before...
Yeah.
...taking a bullet. I watched the end credits as well, because I saw some screencasts of it. Also, it's a banter of an ending team as well. But there's just little things in there, little details that they changed that were different in this episode. Like, for instance, at the end, there was like the shadows of three people all on the pavement. But in this episode, at the end, there's only two shadows left.
On a production level, I can't comment on last week's, but this looked like the first time I'd seen where it looked like they were pressed for time in places. There were particularly the scenes with Enta and the brother. There were some bits where the brother was turning round and it was like, oh yeah, it looks like they had to.
I think the thing that's throwing them in this episode is they don't have the cop song and they don't have the Kappa song.
That's
they don't have the filler stuff. They have to fill the entire fucking half hour block kind of thing.
which is good, you know, for a narrative swerve.
But obviously it is affecting the production. Yeah.
Maybe not. Well, but it, that being said, I think the material speaks for itself, and this is gets you right in the feel bads.
And also, Cody's old face from One Piece showed up at one point. That's his reactions.
When I saw that tweet of yours, I was thinking that, and I was like, is Cody the same age as these kids? Because I kind of forget that in One Piece sometimes.
That is a good question. Cody,
it's hard out there in the Navy, you know, you put years on you.
Kobe, rather, not Cody.
Sorry,
I got it wrong as well, don't worry. Yeah, I'm trying to, how old is he? He's 18 years old now. He was 16 when he first appeared. So okay, he's older than them. He was late puberty, and it ran over him like a lorry.
I don't know. He probably wasn't eating right. He was like an indentured servant on the pirate ship.
That's true, yes.
Get him in the Navy, get him 3 square meals a day and plenty of exercise, hauling ropes and rigging and masts and stuff, and he's, no, now he's, what's he now? Is he like a vice admiral?
No, he's nowhere near that yet. He is...
He's not even a captain,
captain.
Is he a captain now?
Yes.
Okay. Captain's pretty good.
I thought he was just below captain.
I think he's one of those guys, he's a captain, but he's probably a lot stronger than the rank would make
it. Yeah,
it's the 6th highest ranking the Marines. More on Vice Admirals and whatnot later, as we get pretty much a rundown of a bunch of Vice Admirals. Then, next up we got Fruits Basket, Episode 8.
It's Episode 9, I put that in wrong.
Oh, you scoundrel.
I knew I had to get something wrong.
9. See you when you get back.
Yuki was my first love, the episode title. Okay. Because I fucked it up completely. I didn't change it from last week.
Making like a liar here.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay, tell us what it was about.
It's mostly about Hatsuharu Soma, who was like a character we saw briefly at the New Year's party at the Soma Estate.
We didn't get to see what animal he was then, but yeah, now he's interacting with Toru, so we're totally going to see what animal he is.
Yeah. He's like a total cool guy. He's wears all his like outlandish fashions, but he's a bit of a fucking doof.
Oh man, he's fucking great. I love like the cold opening. It's kind of like a bunch of girls looking at him and it's like, oh my god, that guy looks cool as shit. Do you think he has a rad motorbike? Do you think he'll take us for a ride? And he puts on like the goggles and the driving gloves and he's just like on an old lady's bike, like ding 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 ding, just driving down the fucking road.
That's not what I expected. Which is what most people say when they meet Haru.
So episode proper starts with them doing the what do they call it, like New Year's marathon or something. They have a term for it, but I've forgotten.
It's like, you know, this rivalry between Kyo and Yuki is just heating up more and more, and it's kind of getting a bit out of hand because like Yuki, for a start, he gets so cold, and then they're supposed to be taking part in the fun run for school, and it's just like, oh, a fun run, a competitive race, eh? Well, that means it's a competition, but I can probably beat you in, aha. And so they go out in the fun run and try and do it. And even though Yuki is like sick, he goes out and does it anyway.
I did like their reason because they do, the girls go first on the marathon and then the guys go after. But the reason they give an in plot reason as to why Haru is like way behind everyone else and manages to meet up with the guys who are in first place by being last place because her friend, one of her friend mitched off school, and the other one is just like lazy as shit, super goth.
Hannah.
I guess might be the thing.
Hannah is great. Like that's why they're probably my two favorite characters in the whole thing.
I'd watch a show about
this.
Them. They're great. Yeah.
Fuck this! Like marathons are for nerds. I'm not going to that. She's just mitched off school, and then
the other one's like just... basically faints at the starting line.
Oh.
It's like, go on without me. I'll walk from here. And the teacher's like, if you're not going to fucking run, just go home. Like. That's all we're doing today.
Well, she just camps out by the school gate and she's just playing cards. And as guys are running by, her phone saying, "Hey, Hannah, why aren't you in a marathon run with us?" Oh, I've got something else to do right here. And then she keeps luring in more of the runners.
Yeah, every time it cuts back, she's got more people in her card game that she's just hustling everyone.
Yeah, and she's using the waves. It's like, well, my waves to tell me it's coming. Straight to flash.
Like that was a good connecting tissue where every time, yeah, they cut back to the school, that card game would be getting more out of hand. But so anyway, that allows Toru to not catch up, but it allows the guys to catch up to her since she's in last place and they're in first. But what also helps is our new guy,
Haru is just
Haru
is just there on the just like camping out or just lying down on the bank of the river.
She mistakes him for an old man who's collapsed because of his grey hair, but he's just chilling. He sets up like a Roadrunner-esque trap to catch our cat boy because he wants to fight him. So they kind of like, let's take this over here off the beaten track, off the racetrack.
Yeah. But while they're doing all that, Yuki has, I think he must have like asthma or something like that. He has something wrong with his lungs. I'm going to say it's probably asthma or something like that, but he has an asthma attack and he's like, shit, we got to bring him back home.
It's whatever it is. It's exasperated by the cold he has. I think this is like getting continuity because they did spend New Year's Day like on the roof in the morning in the winter. Really? And it's just like, yeah, maybe that's how he caught a fucking cold, guys. Be more sensible.
Yeah. This is a job for Haru. Hey, Toru, it's a good thing you're a cute girl, because I'm going to hug someone that better be cute. I was like, what are you talking about, Prince? Oh, and...
And I was expecting him to be the horse, because that would have made more sense, but I'm guessing that's the joke.
No, he's an ox, because he's bull-headed.
He's a moo cow.
Yeah, and he might be very calm and very staid and relaxed at one moment, but he can make a sweep for you if you put him the wrong way. So they just lead him. They just like put Yuki on top of him and just walking this cow home. It's like they have a hell of a time getting rid of these school kids who kept trying to chase us. It's like, whoa, there's a cow on the street. What's going on? So they bring it back to Shigeru's house and put him back up in his room. And that's where Haru kind of lays out his tragic backstory and how he relates to Yuki. It was like in the story of the Zodiac. The ox was kind of made a fool of because the rat rolled on top of the ox's head most of the way and then jumped off, and he was made a fool of by the rat. And I guess in the Soma family they take that story very seriously and they equate every member of the family who's under the curse, you know, they must exhibit the same traits as they were in the story. So I think Haru, he's probably some kind of fucking idiot because he's the ox and the ox is always a fucking idiot, so he must be stupid too. And then he's like, no, I'm not stupid. It's the rat's fault. I'm not stupid. I hate the fucking rat guy.
He ended up blaming the rat for making him sound like he's stupid, and he confronted the first time he met our boy, he confronted him about it, and he said, I was like, but you're not actually stupid, are you? And he's like, no, I'm not stupid. And he's like, I believe you. Because, I figure it's that he is at to live up to the expectations of being, representing this fucking Zodiac thing rather than being his own person.
Yeah. Mm. And in the same way, the family are also equally as derisive of Yuki as a rat, because you see the rat was like a dirty cheater who just fucking cheated his way to get to the banquet first. So he's also like worthy of our criticism. And Harry's like, oh, well, you and I are not so different after all. Also, I love you. And I don't laugh. He goes through this whole spiel and then Toru is just cool story, bro. Just has nothing to add to that, just a cool story, bro.
Yeah, because he thinks his story isn't that big a deal, but like it makes her understand him and like him a little better as a person, and also kind of get his personality a little better, because he has the, what do they call it, the light version and the shadow version or something, the dark one.
The dark version, you know.
Because he's a black and white cow.
Yeah, and he has black and white hair, but it's mostly white hair, but he's got a little bit of like kind of like the black underneath it, I don't know.
But it's the idea that most of the time he's quite passive and like dozy as shit. But yeah, he becomes like really like crazy when he gets competitive and really emotional and everything like that. Like you say, a cow can turn on you.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
But you're seeing as well as like with Yuki and also with Kyo, and that's when the Toru has been this sort of calming presence. Yuki doesn't seem as wound up as it used to be. And Kyo is, you know, still an angry guy who'll, is prone to violent mood swings, but not so much anymore.
like the way he puts it with the two of them, like they used to be really cold to each other, but now they're like getting emotionally involved with each other. Even if they're starting with fucking anger and competitiveness and stuff, it's still better than just them not interacting. It's at least a kind of interaction, you know, which is an improvement from his opinion. Yeah.
Yeah. And then like Shigure, he has to go out to, you know, I better go explain to the school about why you kids came home early. And it's just, you know, think, what a responsible adult, he's just going there to fucking purr on girls. Yeah.
I assume the idea is like that he can research stuff for his like romance novels and whatnot, but whatever. He ends up caught in the card game anyway, so.
Exactly. Yeah. It's good now because they're bringing in more cousins and characters and stuff, because Hattori shows up at the end just to give Yuki a bit of a checkup as well. And there's just more of an ensemble cast building over the episodes.
Yeah.
So we're seeing a lot more fun interactions. For instance, like with Hannah and just doing a crazy card game out in front of the school, and just Toru interacting with whatever new weird Soma family members come our way as well. And also just like they're being drawn into her orbit. They've all been living under this pall or under the shadow all their lives, and they see that there is possibly a hope for them or a life for them outside of that, and a worth for them outside of just being you are just the inner circle of this family. Like we don't really care about your well-being, we just care about your place within the sacred circle of the Zodiac, and that's all you're here for.
From what I can go from, like, so far, and I think this was the case with the comic, again, I only kind of remember if I've read things after I've watched them, it's been so bloody long. I think it's the idea that while a lot of them embody the nature of the animal that they are, they don't embody the role that the animal has in the Zodiac story.
Mm.
And it's the idea that they have these pre-described places in society, places within the context of the story and everything that's really like holding them down and not letting them break out of that.
Yeah, and that is the real curse that they live under.
Yeah.
Mm.
Righty-ho, then we've got Bungo Stray Dogs, Season 3, Episode 33, The Masked Assassin. The start of the cannibalism arc, which I assume is going to take us through to the end of the series.
It's fucking kicking off anyway. When Dostoevsky's about, 3 days in town, and he's already engineered this dangerous, dire situation.
He seems to have been working on it for a bit. Like, it initially seems that there's someone going around trying to kill...
Gifted ability users.
Yeah, that's it. And they don't quite know what his ability is because he seems to have what's the fucking airwalking thing from One Piece again?
Yes,
and something else going on. That was nice. I was just like, so okay, it's clearly that's not his ability, but he's definitely using an ability to make it look like that's his ability. It is someone we've seen before. So there's kind of a fun mystery thing there, but that's just a fake. That's Dostoevsky trying to distract you from the real plot.
Yeah. Essentially, Dostoevsky, he's engineered kind of the almost kind of assassinations or attempted assassinations of the head of the Armitage Dependency and the head of the Port Mafia with a particular ability where they're affected by... It's some kind of like a spiritual organism will like grow inside them and kill them within 48 hours.
I probably described it as like an alien or something. I can't.
It's basically a virus.
Because I think I'm going to guess because he explains that it's suicide to try and take the virus, touch the virus yourself. So presumably you can also catch this virus from the person who's got it. Which I guess is the thing to prevent the plan of just letting them both die.
Because or door, the virus... just letting Dazai go in there and just notify it.
Yes.
Mm.
Yeah. And the idea of it is if one of the afflicted hosts dies, then it will break the spell on the other one.
Yeah, so hence, like they don't, but they both don't have to die. It's like if you kill one prematurely, then the virus doesn't come to fruition, kind of thing. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thus, we have
the peace talks are fucking off.
Two great powers of the city who have their leaders both like almost at death's door, and often the fastest way is for us just to kill the leader of the other one and then break the curse we can save our own leader. And
yeah, even your man... Like
Mafia goes straight for this.
The gravity guy is kind of like, yeah, we should totally just go straight for the guy who fucking instigated this, but we know we only have 2 fucking days, so we should probably just actually do the thing he wants us to do, even though that sucks. Yeah.
Like Chuya, he has some hesitancy about the whole thing because this is like a big step, but hey, we gotta save the boss.
Mm.
And whereas the agency don't think they can do it without Dazai,
he's the guy who could like nullify like any number of them. Like he's one of their heavy hitters.
But Dazai has appeared to have got himself deliberately shot by Dostoevsky's assassin. His third assassin.
I knew you were going to follow up on the crime scene. I knew you knew that I was going to follow up on the crime scene. I knew that you were going to follow up on the crime scene and I was going to shoot you. I knew I was going to be shot at the crime scene. Well, why did you get shot then, dipshit?
Well, I think it's because he wants him not to be available.
He wants to give him, like, confidence in himself and everything.
Well, I think it's to force them to think of a different solution.
So they're not dependent on him? Or
than just killing the Portmath, killing Maury.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I assume, despite his powers, that would be his number one plan.
Yeah. Also, Dazai was able to glean some information about what Dostoevsky is after, considering that book.
Yeah.
From what he says to him.
And he wants to get rid of, is it like the sins and foolishness of people?
Well, people are inherently sinful and foolishness, but especially the gifted. So I want to create a world where they no longer exist. Mm. And this book can make whatever's written into reality. Because hey, this is like an anime thing about authors with superpowers. Yes. So,
Dazai steals his hat. I like that bit because. That's always like making the point of how they're similar, but then after he gets shot, he points out that the way they're different is, yes, we both think that mankind is, foolish and sinful, but I like it that way. It would be interesting if they weren't.
I thought he meant with the hat on, it looked quite alike because of the character designs. But
I guess so, yeah. You need to have a different costume in this, or haircut, or whatever.
Yeah, and the assassin turns out to be Nathaniel Hawthorne, who's using his blood powers to simulate these other powers.
I did like the way also it ended up against, what's his name, with Rashomon.
Akutagawa.
Yes.
Yeah, because it's like, you're here to take revenge for the time I killed the woman that you're after. And he's like, who are you? And it's like, oh, that's not what's happening. Because it all seemed to line up right up to that point, you know?
Yes, because Hawthorne seems to know, he knows that, who was it who got injured?
Lady Rogan with the Wind.
He knows that she exists, and presumably that Dostoevsky's promised that he's going to revive her if he helps him. But yeah, he seems to have lost other memories.
Yeah, he's got like his main focus of bringing her back.
Margaret Mitchell.
Revenge.
That's right.
And we get a lot of Maury and Elise in this as well, when they, where he like fobs off the police officer who turns out to be Dostoevsky, unfortunately for him, with, oh no, the car didn't blow. It wasn't a bomb. My daughter here fed Mr. Carr some orange, thought Mr. Carr would like some orange juice.
That's not a very good excuse, bro.
I love how she's looking at him, thinking, how old do you think I am? I'm not four. What the fuck?
Well, it wasn't just that. It was the how old do you think I am? It was, you're calling me that, and also, like, you're making me look like the asshole here. Also, that's not how that would work. Like, everything about this is annoying her. It's kind of great. I like the multiple double lines in that, because initially when she gets in the car, I was like, oh, is the car going to explode? And I was like, no, it's fine. And it's like, then he gets in the car, it's remotely exploded, but they're fine. But that's an excuse to have a police officer walk up to them and ask, hey, are you guys okay? And then stab him.
The simplest way is to do it, but going to be the more complicated method.
Yeah, yeah. Plans within plans. Because the plan that you think it is, like this murderer or this serial killer going around, isn't the plan. This is just a distraction, basically.
Yeah, it is quite impressive how Dostoevsky has engineered this, because he hasn't next to near the amount of resources that the Port Mafia has, for instance. He's just got a couple of guys, he's got a lot of planning, and he's got a lot of just fucking good ideas.
Mm.
Like with a minimum amount of manpower on his part, he's managed to have the two
the two main rivals.
Two large organizations in the city at war with each other to the death. Mm.
I guess this will carry on for a few episodes now.
Yeah, it ends with them going like, hey, should we pair off one on one or just fucking go at it right now in this corridor?
Another thing I was wondering why they didn't do just, whereabouts the virus that the two bosses have been afflicted with. But Dazai is, if he's in surgery at the moment. He can get the bullet out. Why doesn't,
I keep forgetting her name. Why isn't the lady in Darn Divinity who can like cure the immortal wound? Why didn't she just go in there and just sort him out?
They stated that as much, like she couldn't cure it, and that was the weird thing. And I'm guessing it's because, like, she'd have to bring them both to the brink of death.
No. I mean, Dazai with a bullet in his gut. Why didn't she just go in there and sort him out?
That was weird. And they were doing it in a separate hospital. Yeah, that bit did catch me. All right. I'm guessing as part of his excuse.
Has she used it on Dazai before at any point?
It will just negate it without him even activating it. It's always turned on with him.
Also maybe his like suicidal tendencies would mean that he can't be brought back from the. If you take him to the brink of death, he's just going to stay there.
Well, that and these suicidal tendencies might kick in where it's like, okay, you're going to bring me to the brink of death. Cower on. Now you can't. Ha ha. I'm just going to straight up die.
Yosano. I keep forgetting her name. I wish we'd just use her more because she was a really fun character.
Well, yeah. I don't know whether it'll be the series, but she's definitely has some more. She's a key part of the story.
Good, because I want to see her threaten people with chainsaws and whatnot.
Yeah.
Reminding myself of the things that on the Wikipedia has already taught me that. I ignored the warnings. It's fine, because I can now spot these things as they're happening, and I won't have to go back and watch them
later.
Still consistently great with its bones, so...
Mm. It's really hitting its stride now. It's like I ratcheted it up. It was already going to be pretty tense. There's no like kind of slow build up. It's just it's gang war straight away.
They give us a few soft episodes to get us back on form, and then go like, now let's fuck it all up.
But the good thing is, you know that there has to be a solution where they don't both die. So that becomes the mystery of like, how does this solution appear in the situation the characters have already set themselves in?
Yeah.
How are they going to not all murder each other in this situation that they're in? But also we're going to get some sweet fights. So,
It's like JoJo. If you defeat the stand user, it'll just stop the ability, but maybe they can deduce whose ability this is and probably track them down and defeat them.
Unless they're like doing like a proxy war, they're making it look like they're baiting the shit out of each other. Your man tracks them down.
We don't even know that Dostoevsky is telling the truth.
Yeah,
all evidence would suggest that he isn't, based on the previous encounters in the
based off everything
series.
He's fucking done so far.
Yes, because the idea is to make it appear that that's what's happening to trigger them doing what he wants them to do. Rightio, next up, I return as it's returned to canon material, Case Closed, or Detective Conan, episode 941, Find Maria-chan, part 1, in which it picks up pretty much where we left it, so I don't know what's been happening in the filler episodes. Presumably they've still been on that school trip, encountering other crimes, because this ends with them returning from their school trip.
There's always a murder, man.
Yes. They explain how Conan hasn't been around the Mori Agency is that he's caught a cold and he was staying with the professor. But then it's all over the news that there was news about the Kiyomizu Temple involving 3 high school detectives.
But none of the other murders they've solved in the meantime.
They may not have been murders, and maybe other things.
I'm
looking at the previous episode. It's called The Missing Girlfriend.
Oh, okay. Yeah, not really newsworthy
the
stuff.
Dangerous fossil finding trip. And apparently one of the detectives was that famous detective who everyone thought was dead. Kudo Shinichi, the high school detective of the East. And then we go away from like the normal, bystander type characters reading this news. And then we see the 3 suspects of being the second in command of the Black Organization reading the news. And we see that, I can't remember her name now. It's the one played by Lum, the new teacher at the school, at the elementary school that all the detective boys go to. She's got a list of dead people, including the name, Haneda Koji. And I'm going to have to remind myself what the relevance of that name is, because I believe it's pertinent to a lot of things which have happened recently, except the recently has been spread out between many, many filler, and that's what I've forgotten. Oh, yes, he's the dead shogi player, who's like, death has been hanging over the series for a long time. It was like episode 861 to 862 was his death case. And that's where they got like the thing, I think things leading towards rum. And that's the idea of the second in command, of which the three suspects all fulfill some of the clues they've got to rum's identity, but not all of them. So we've got the teacher, we've got the cop, and we've got the chef. I've not seen any of the episodes with the chef. And I've only seen the teacher, like, briefly, not any of the key ones. Also see she's got loads of weird scars on her arms as well in this episode, as she's checking the internet and reading that Hang Shinichi Kudo has returned from the dead. Meanwhile, what of this actual episode title, Find Maria-chan? Well, one of their classmates, Maria-chan, hasn't been to school. And so the detective boys go out in search, try and find her. And they discover that she'd gone to her grandmother's house who'd recently died. And so they go and investigate, and they found that the grandmother had like left a arrow puzzle for her. Which is like all these different clues which lead to arrows or things which look like arrows, which then lead you to more arrows. So you're just basically following a trail of arrows through the house. So that's what they're doing this episode. Meanwhile, the professor and Conan are basically going, how the hell do we convince everybody that I wasn't there when there is like news footage of me being there? And so that's their episode. They haven't figured it out by the end. So presumably they will figure it out by the end of next episode, and the kids will have found out where this girl is, because they've just found some stairs to the basement at the end of the episode. So yes, next week, Find Maria-chan Part 2. Yes, a weird mix of like a, presumably this child isn't dead, because that would be incredibly bleak that all these preschoolers are going to spend two episodes wandering around only to find a dead 6-year-old or something in the basement.
Case has traumatized children before.
It has, but I don't know if many children get murdered in this. I can't remember ever seeing an episode where someone of their own age is killed.
Maybe she never existed at all.
We see what she looks like, so we know who we're looking for. Will Conan the Professor figure out how to pull a Peter Parker or a Batman? That's like, no, here's a photo of me with my good friend, Bruce Wayne. I can't possibly be the same person. This is obviously, we've got to convince everybody that I'm still dead. Even though I was on a school trip with loads of people. I presume it will have something to do with the many other people who look exactly like him.
Well, I guess the karate guy who looks exactly like him was there as well.
I believe that is probably how they're going to get around it, yes.
Yeah, that seems like the most obvious one.
Then we've got One Piece 887, an explosive situation, two Emperors of the Sea going after Luffy. In which two Emperors of the Sea go after Luffy, or argue about who's going to get to kill Luffy. So this is the part of the story where Big Mom rings up Kaido and says, Luffy's heading towards you, don't kill him, I want to kill him because of all the trouble he's made for me. And Kaido's like, no, I want to kill him because of all the trouble he's made for me. And then Big Mom says, don't forget that favour you owe me, it's a life favour. And we still haven't learned in the comic what the favor is, why Kaido apparently owes the favor.
Like, wouldn't that be a bad thing for him? Because he's trying to kill himself.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
it's weird that he'd be like, "You did save my life." It's like, but he wants to die. That's his whole thing.
I don't know. I guess someone got a bad deal out of that then.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Yeah, but then we also get Shanks seeing the news about Luffy becoming, everyone calling him the Fifth Emperor. And we get Garp in conversation with various other Marines, including Hina and a couple of characters who I believe debuted in Gold, the Gold movie. They are two Vice Admirals who were suggested in the SBS column that's in the collections. Readers suggested, like, these should be the new admiral who hasn't been named yet, but turns out they are not, but hey, he used them anyway. And likewise, their faces are based on famous Japanese actors.
Yeah. Well, I kind of like the way, like, he does things like
yes.
that. It's the fun little detail, like, for instance, when Kikemon, people would send in their ideas for wrestlers to put in the thing, and then, yeah, well, make a guy in there, a wrestler, and scribble into a cool wrestling guy. Or a dumb wrestling guy, but still kind of cool.
Yeah. Obviously, yes, he did, because he submitted one to Kinnikuman, and that's where Panda Man came from.
Mm-hmm.
That was the Kinnikuman character he submitted. Karakuri Circus did that as well in the manga.
We're popping to put in there?
Yes, yeah. I think there was like a competition to submit a puppet, and then a competition to submit a one of the Shirigane, if I remember correctly.
Right.
Yeah, and so they're discussing Big Mom and Kaido talking to each other because the Marines have heard all about this because they were just using a non-secure line as if to like let the Marines know what they were planning on doing. Also, we get Barcelino asking what's his name? The magma guy.
Akainu.
Yes, he's like, do you want me to go and attack them? And he's like, no, don't go to Wano. It's like unaffiliated. We don't know what dangers lurk in Wano. And he's like, ah, yes, the samurai. And yeah, they're basically Garp and Hina and the others are discussing this, and then they'd like bring up, oh, well, we don't want those two meeting because you remember Rocks, the thing which made you the hero of the Marines. And then he's like, ah, that's a lot. You're young Hina. How do you know about that? And then the narrator explains that, well, it doesn't explain much. He explains a little more than what was in the comic, but nothing really. It's like,
right.
Rocks was a person at all, was like the name of a crew.
Well, we don't know. We don't know whether Rocks was their captain or the crew or something else. It has something to do with Kaido and Big Mom. Like, they were part of whatever it is, and it's a bad sign that they might get back together again.
Maybe Big Mom and Kaido both came up on this guy's ship.
Would be my guess. My guess is like everybody who's around 60 years old, because this was 40 years ago, so it's 20 years before Gold Roger. So presumably, like everybody, like probably this was a crew with Whitebeard and Roger and Big Mom and Kaido under some other person.
Oh, like basically like the prior generation.
That would
like
be what
all
my
started.
Guess would be, yeah.
Yeah, similar to like Shanks and Buggy being on the same boat. It's not coincidental. It's just there were less pirates, and that's why we're in the age of pirates now, because everyone who was on these couple of main big ships all sort of shot off and made their own thing. Yeah.
The ocean is large and vast, but everybody fucking knows each other on it.
Yeah.
All the important people, they. And then they're like commenting, oh, yeah, your grandson's making. Has been doing some big things, and like Garp's like, not big enough yet. He's not there yet. And then we get a massive amount of flashbacks as they're doing in all these episodes. Which basically is the, like a quick, like a 10 minute, and I might be undercutting it there. The bulk of the episode is really, recapping the establishment of, what's the name of the, it's the, was it the Pirate Ninja Zoo Alliance? Well, I can't remember which order it all comes
into. Oh, yeah, yeah. I can't think of what the fuck they're called now.
And in fact, may not even get that far. That might be next week's episode. Might get the zoo bit in. And then at the end, we get the elders. Someone's come to visit them. And when they see who it is, they tell the guards to leave them alone with this person. And we see it's Shanks. And he's come to speak to them about a certain pirate. Do not get excited, dear viewer. We will not see the end of this conversation. So I think there's like a month more of these episodes, because I think it's the 7th of July is when Wano starts and we get the new director and everyone's kind of super excited that it's going to be a great looking show.
How long has the current director been at this?
I don't know. But it's the guy who did Movie Z is taking over as the TV director.
Oh, well. Okay. I guess, yeah. That's a spicy meatball indeed.
Yes, as we head to Wano. And we'll see how they pace that out. I think there's lots of things in Wano where I guess they can fill out some scenes a bit.
Yeah, he's been doing that more and more. He's like, I'm barely going to cover this fight in the manga. And it's like, oh yeah, that's going to be like an episode or two.
It's kind of paying off in the comic at the moment, I feel. Because now in the comic, it feels like, oh, we're getting there. It's soon we're going to get a panel with all the crew back together again.
Yeah, yeah. It's building all right.
After however many years it's been.
God.
Did you watch Pretty Cure this week? No.
I did. I got all caught up with it. There's some pretty fun episodes there. They're getting a lot more about the blue cat, the phantom thief, because they go back to the casino plant for another job, because actually the blue cat, she lures the pretty girls there. She's like, I need your help for a big heist, because you got something in that guy's vault. It's one of the princess color pens, and I want all the little loot inside there. So you and Mies has got to work together to get it out of there. But we're pretty curious. We're like the advertiser of justice. We can't be helping the criminal. But you gotta see the universe, right? Come on. But Blue Cat isn't that heartless or heinous at all. Actually, a good phantom thief robs from the rich, gives to the poor. And presumably also, besides looting the Bullet Boys rich guys, is also trying to get artifacts from Planet Rainbow. Presumably, there's an off planet Rainbow, which was like decimated and destroyed, and its riches like pillaged and plundered and spread across the galaxy. So I think she's trying to gather all the lost artifacts of her former planet and try and either restore it or just like preserve the memory of it. She's got a bit more of an edge to her backstory than the rest of the girls do, who just like, I was a schoolgirl and now I fight crime as a pretty magical girl. And there was a press release like saying, oh, it's going to be a fifth Precure in Star Twinkles. Oh, I wonder who it will be. It'll be Pink Cat, it'll be Blue Cat, of course. Yeah. The most recent one that's there was a cool little story, which is, Hikaru's mam is actually a manga artist, and she's having trouble, trying to come up with a good story, because she's got an opportunity to, pitch her idea for a serialized manga, but she doesn't know what to do. But Hikaru was her biggest fan, and is going to, get the rest of the girls to pitch in and be her assistants and try to inspire her. But the magazine only wants, romance stories about doctors and love triangles, and she only knows how to draw sci-fi and fantasy, and that just don't sell. And it's kind of shit, because it's kind of implying that, oh, what you're saying, the audience for this comic, which presumably be maybe probably teenage girls to young women, they wouldn't be into sci-fi or fantasy. I don't know, but that's just the imprint I have, so we got to go with it. And the character's man kind of tries to
make an attempt to go along with it, but it's just not good enough. And the characters try to inspire her, because remember the whole theme of this precure is about kind of imagination and using it and how it can make the world look kind of a nicer, happier place. And it's a kind of cute little moment where Hikaru's like favorite manga is like this silly little story that she's it's only one volume long that her mom wrote and gave to her, and it's kind of the catalyst of trying to inspire her again, because like you can kind of try to attempt to kind of catch on with what's bad and what was popular, but if not being true to what your actual passions are, then it'll come across as false. And it's a big wide world out there. There's probably people out there would love to read a story about four preteen girls who turn to magical girls and go out and fight crime and stuff with some pussy animal mascots. Not that she would know anything about that, of course.
I was going to say, is this like the Sarah Zenmai thing? Sorry, not Sarah Zenmai. Why am I mixing up that name? Gurizeni. There we go. Thing where it's like, oh, what a brave and manga artist he would be to write about the fucking pinch hitter in baseball kind of thing. A thing that nobody cares about. It's like, girls aren't into fantasy and sci-fi, which is specifically what this is.
Yeah.
And it's like, how brave it would be to follow your dreams and do those things anyway. Picking up itself, basically, within its own plot.
Yeah. And it's like, it's just like, you know, like Frippity Guru is like a wildly popular franchise. So it's trying to.
Yeah. There's definitely money there.
Yeah. But it was like, you know, a little bit kind of like for the younger audience here. It's like the inside baseball like story about how mangas get made and the often crushing editorial decisions and feedback that may cause your favorite stories to go out of print long before you think they're due to do so. It's not that the manga artist hates you. It's just editors hate them even more, so they won't get to see their story continue.
It's just when it gets caught up in the crushing wheels of the industry. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of nice when it comes to the four. It kind of gets lost sometimes, but I thought this was, you know, it's got some kind of nice themes on there, but it doesn't like touching them nearly enough. It's kind of like a more of a sort of nebulous, you know, the power of friendship kind of thing. And I know that's kind of other previous iterations that I've had, fairly kind of more well-defined themes, that they kind of stick to and kind of build upon, which I haven't seen it do so much. It's still like tons of fun to watch, but it doesn't really kind of draw it in as much as it could. That being said, these episodes have been pretty fun. They've got a bit more pace to them, and they're putting together more of a kind of, again, similar to Fruitbank, more of a kind of an ensemble cast as it goes on. Episodes are usually better when they're off on some crazy planet doing weird things out in space. I will give it that much. So the more often it does that, the better. And maybe when I get the fifth member, they'll have a more adventures out in space where it should be. Because that's a routine I tend to forget about sometimes, that, oh yeah, this is supposed to be kind of space and aliens and stars, like themed, pretty good as well. But they only go to episodes, just go to space or reference that like every episode in a while. I thought, nah, come on, get out there, and this is supposed to be like Space Danny for kids. I thought it was anyway. I'm still enjoying it and it is good, but, even my kind of cursory knowledge of other precure iterations, thing is, this is not really at the same level as some of those.
Right.
But still pretty fun. I think it is giving me a little bit more of a week, a little bit more to kind of do on it. I mean, the mega episode was pretty fun. There were some good gags and good scenes in there. Yeah, I think it's a bit kind of slower to get its role going, but I think it's starting to get there.
And continuing our Sunday Toei extravaganza, I watched Ryosuga episode 12. I can't remember what the episode title was. So this episode, the previous episode, they'd met another Dino Knight whose name I can't remember. He's like a, he sets quizzes and he, is Firebase. Anyway, this episode, Tiramigo, if you remember the Tyrannosaurus one who taught himself to talk, is now jealous. He's in a sulk of this new one who can talk better than him. Dime Volcano, that's it. And so he starts setting his own quiz, and they're like, that's not really a quiz, that's just like a question that you're just like, it's a open-ended question that everyone knows the answers to. And then he gets into more of a sulk. Anyway, the Minosaur in this episode has been created from a, firefighter who really wanted to work in the movies. And so what this thing does is it projects images onto smoke that it generates, which causes them problems because they keep on making it appear. Well, first of all, they create it because they're trying, the Druidons are trying to trap, Dime Volcano and like enslave it and use it for their own purposes. So the first thing they do is they project a sexy female version of Dime Volcano. So it's blue rather than orange. It has lipstick and it has a bow on its head. And it works. Dime Volcano instantly falls in love with this image. So when the Rangers try and battle it, it then starts making itself, projecting like images of their allies. So first of all, it puts Yui up and, the Red Ranger's like, ah, I know it's an illusion, but I can't hear my friend. And then he's about to convince, he's managed to convince, psych himself up and convince that he can hit her. And then it changes into, the Pink Ranger. He pulls himself back at the last minute. Ah, I can't hear her. And then she throws the, combined robot into, various buildings and then turns into, the Blue Ranger and melts like, he starts like shouting at him, trying to convince him not to hit him. But even before he can finish the sentence, he's already hit him. And he's like, he didn't even give me a chance to finish the sentence and he whacked me. Which is a recurring joke, how nobody seems to care about Melt throughout the series. And yeah, they defeat it. The firefighter recovers. The firefighter used to go to school with Yui. And so, there's like a bit of comedy when the dad's like, who are you? What are you doing with my daughter? She's not ready to get married yet. There's also like various like clues. The episode opens with the dad sort of sleepily saying Dime Volcano's name in his sleep. And they're like, you're like, how does he know the name? And then we also learn, and they're also questioning throughout, like, who released Dime Volcano? None of us did it, so there must be another Rio Solga somewhere. And they all get excited about having another ally. But it turns out it's not another ally. It is Guy Zorg, a character who is a thing I've not seen. He is a mysterious knight who resembles the Rio Solgas to the point where the other two monsters say he looks a bit like a real Soga. That's a bit weird. He was the villain in the 4-part series Super Sentai Strongest Battle, which was basically a tournament between various Super Sentai. They were like teams of themed guys. I can't remember if it was like a web series. I know people are fans of it. I just was like, oh no, it was like a 4-week gap thing between the previous show and this show. So maybe I need to go back and watch it now. But basically it was a suit of armor which would possess other characters and take them over. So presumably that is what has happened here. So it may well be the 6th Rio Soga is wearing this armor and they'll have to get him out of it to turn him into a good guy. Anyway, despite my predictions, the current Druidon guy, Wizzle, whatever his name is, has not been killed in this episode. And him and the little, Creon have decided they don't like, neither of them like Guy Zorg. So we shall await to see what happens next week, whether there'll be any more attempts to seduce dinosaurs. Oh, I know what happens next week. The preview was the Prime Minister of Japan is from the same tribe that all the real Sogas are, and also because it's real Soga, apparently wants to commit suicide. That'll be the third person in 13 episodes who wants to kill themselves. For kids.
Yeah, I thought like robot dinosaurs would be a bit more upbeat and uplifting, but no.
Then, finally, on Toei, the only thing we didn't talk about was Zio. Gegege no Kitaro. This week's episode, episode 58, the Han Gyojin Strange Kamaboko Tale.
When I saw the fucking opening, I was like, what? What?
This takes some turns. It's quite a trip.
This was the Kitaro I wanted.
I knew this is exactly the kind of thing, because it just feels like this probably most definitely had to be like straight out of the comic, because it involves Kitaro getting mutilated and turned into something, and then coming back to life in a horrifying form and getting his own back on the one who wronged him, condemning them to a fate of horror and despair.
So it kind of opens with Nozomi Otoko selling Kitaro into slavery.
I forgot the monster's name instantly.
Han Gyojin.
All he has is this dumb sea magic. So I had an octopus like get fish for me to make these. They're like fish cakes, aren't they? Bread. It might be more appropriate. But he's too dumb and he kept attacking ships, and that was, you know, getting us a bit too much attention. So I'm going to put Kitaro's brain into this giant squid that is my servant. And Kitaro's like, well, fucking turn me back. And he's like, I will if you get me like, what's it, like 200 tons of fish?
Mm.
Something like that. A decent amount where basically he's working Kitaro like he's his servant. That'll come up later. And when Kitaro's like outlived his usefulness, he's going to chop him up and turn him into a special fucking limited run of the fucking fish cake. Nasty.
Well, that's after he gets injured when he gets into a fight with a whale, which was
does have to fight a whale. Yeah,
parody
sorry,
of like a famous drawing. I'm sure I've seen that pose before.
I've seen the thing of I think is that the American National History Museum, but there's definitely like a giant fucking papier-mâché or whatever model of a giant squid fighting a sperm whale or something that I saw in person. I can't remember where the fuck that museum that is, though. No, it doesn't matter.
I did like one of the drawings in the eye catch was Kitaro friends with a whale.
They did that on purpose. Yeah.
If only.
As you say, he's no longer fit for work, so therefore he's going to chop him up and sell him as premium Kamaboko.
And the only reason they discover this is because Nozomi Otoko has been... initially he seems mad that Kitaro has been... His friend Kitaro has been turned into food, but it's like, it's because... Like, check it out, I put him up as food. And I was like, dude, what the fuck? I'm in charge of online sales.
Luckily, a rat was there. It got picked up by a crow, which then deposited that to a cat, and the cat goes to Nekomusume, who gets the whole situation related to her.
That's a great sequence. There was another great cat right at the start who looked really pissed off when Kitaro's coming to town. Yes, so they have to buy...
Everyone in town was rude to him, including the cats. Yeah, yeah.
They're going to have to buy all the Kitaro... Kamaboko, and then take him to the Yokai Hospital, which finally made an appearance.
I love that. Maybe that's why they wanted to save it for this fucking episode, because they were talking about the expense of the Yokai, because all of this was expense, and all of this was fucking funded entirely by the sandwich, because apparently she's just very good at investments.
Yeah. She's very thrifty. She's a thrifty old gal.
She doesn't even
want
to pay back for it. She's like, no, I got loads of money. She just has like all the... when she pulls out the one
card...
The other
bank books, yeah.
Yeah, but the other bank books, I was just like, holy shit, like, she's loaded.
like, well, the stock market assets.
Shobitcoin.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Like, I assume she bought it low and then sold it high. Just got out of it as soon as quick as possible. Yeah. But yeah.
Just using my natural ability for thrift, I've conquered the economy of this country.
Which just goes to show that, like the our yokai in this episode isn't even that good at business. It's just like, I've got like Aquaman powers and I'm going to use it to sell fish.
Which is the key to their revenge they take. I also like the little bit of continuity, and so we get like this little bit of news, like just thrown in, that one of the members of the idol group, Batteries, who I think were like, one of the first 10 episodes, is got engaged to this, investor, and then by the end of the episode has, split up when the investor has lost loads of money on the Han Gyojin's, business
fish cake scheme.
You like, and he was obviously watching this news and everything like that, and it's kind of like the idea that that seems like a really tempting thing to be, but like the market is fickle, and as Kid Rose says as well, it's like, yes, enjoy your
their revenge is that he's hiring maids, and he's really taken with this one maid,
this one-eyed maid,
but he tries to seduce her, and she says, oh, we could never be, it would never work. You're a yokai and I'm a human. And then, who tells him that there's an operation to get turned into a
yokai hospital?
Yeah.
Someone planted the information on him.
I can't, anyway, he goes to the hospital, gets turned into a human.
It's irreversible. You do understand this, right, sister?
I do it for love.
And he comes back, and then turns out the maid was actually Kitaro in disguise.
I thought it was going to be like Nika Musa, maybe. But no, this is even better.
He got the eye, he got the hair. Oh, it had the eye
thing, but I didn't expect Kitaro to have such a tasty pair of gams on him. Like,
that's true. His head on the body. I thought when they brought him to the yoga hospital, did he get made up in that way? But it's just kind of an illusion, because after he leaves the building, he's back to his regular form.
Yeah, no, he's just wearing a rubber mask. he can just walk in heels. We didn't know this about Kitaro.
No, he used to stay at that vibe for the rest of the series until another episode where he gets changed back.
He kind of looks a bit like the Yuki Onna from Poo Guru.
No, I initially thought it was going to be the cat girl until like the you saw the singular eye and the other one covered by hair. I was like, oh no, that's Kitaro in a wig. The most beautiful woman I've ever seen. Kitaro in a wig. And a rubber mask.
Yeah, if you find the pictures from the 1971 version of this story, they're pretty funny as well. Because it is there's barely a disguise. It's Kitaro in a dress with lipstick and a bow in his hair.
Man, that sounds pretty good too, yeah.
I like how Kitaro didn't even attack fucking...
Yeah, he's all winking. He's like, please, let me live. And Kitaro just walks out of there, and he's like, oh, really?
Creepy towards him. I got like a kind of a svelte maid body, but I have the Kitaro head walking towards it. And then I just walk out the door. I'm like, oh, man, I just really freak him out doing this.
and then his business goes under because someone leaks pictures of the staff at the factory misbehaving.
I wonder who leaked those videos.
Yeah.
I assume he took them as insurance.
Yeah. Did that switch you off, Brian?
No, that was fine. I was fine with that one.
But he was licking it on the fucking assembly line, man.
We're getting any flashbacks now.
And then, yes, he's down and out. Everything's gone wrong for him, mate. But he doesn't commit suicide.
He almost does. So, man, this is, again, ostensibly hearing in like a...
And like Kitaro just watching him, it was like, I was just waiting to see if he jumped in front of that fucking train, but he didn't.
Yeah, I've made my point. If you love money so much, living in the human world, let's see if you fucking get on without it. Or get on, fucking make your way in it.
And the, is the encoder thing is like he's going fishing and he meets up with, Ratman again.
Yes.
You're as pathetic as Ratman now. How do you like that?
You're the one who ruined my life.
I like Sunakake Obaba's taken, and it's like, it's just money. It's useful when you have it, but when you don't, you'll find a way to get by.
Yeah, she's got a good attitude of like, well, you can't take it with you, and I'm already dead, so.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this episode because it was
it was good. It had a lot going on in that.
Like, it's like the sinister atmosphere that it establishes like from the very beginning. We think, oh, this is going to be another kind of monster of the week killer or something we've been getting, but no, it just takes so many turns. Just with the scenes and stuff early on when Kira's doing this initial investigation, getting the door slammed in his face, and it's like, what's going on here? His town's hiding something. You got Han Gyojin, you know, inside the factory, eating fish cakes in the shadows. What's going on there?
I did like the way Han Gyojin, while being a complete bastard in this episode, was like a really kind of crap villain. And, you know, he was kind of saying to Kira, I was like, I just use sea magic to turn you into a thing. And he's like, well, fucking use sea magic to turn me back. It's like, I don't know that. And he's like, you just said you know sea magic. And he's like, oh, yeah, I did just say that. You know, he's not very good at his job.
I says, I know sea magic, but I can't do nothing with it. Apparently, you can do whatever the fuck you want with sea magic. So I don't know why you're so down to yourself.
Like, he's just, and even the kid were going like, what do you want money for anyway? You're a yokai. And it's just like, I want to live like a big shot is basically his entire fucking deal.
A penthouse apartment. I want to be able to watch things at BTV, wear cool suits and drink brandy in like a bath full of money and then throw all these little notes in here, have these sexy ladies dance around trying to catch him.
Yeah, yeah. He wants to live that life. That's his dream. And he lives it very shortly.
I think it's got a bit, because of that, it's got a little bit of a laughing salesman vibe of like,
yeah,
a guy getting everything he wants, but then it all turning to dust.
It's just like an up and down. It goes from like this pervading sinister atmosphere to outright farce to getting sinister again and then back into the farce situation. It's walking that line of wobbling either side of it, but it never falls off.
We failed to mention, like, when they buy all of him in the fucking auction, all of Kitaro as fish cake, and he's like, they kind of like scrape him off the little block and he's just kind of like flopping around going like, well, this is a fine to do.
And each of the pieces have their own little voice and sentience. So you got like a whole
it's weird and gross
pieces of fish cake Kitaro wobbling around.
It's good stuff.
The best stuff.
Righty-ho. I believe that is everything we watched, unless anyone's got any surprises they want to spring on me.
Oh, I think that's probably enough.
Righty ho, we'll be back next week with more Let's Go JoJo. Goodbye.
Bye.
Good evening.